Shalom, and thank you for studying the Book of Galatians with us at BethEmmanuel.org. Pastor Lancaster has edited all of the sermons from his Galatians series into a book titled Holy Epistle to the Galatians. Click on the Books and Resources tab to order a copy today.
So far, in our study of the Holy Apostle Paul's epistle to the God-fearing Gentile Galatians, we have covered three chapters, which means we have come halfway through the text, and not without a few surprises along the way, I should say. So today we will begin with the last verse of chapter 3. If you can turn in your Bibles to Galatians chapter 3, and we'll start with the last verse where we left off last week, and then we will begin to work our way into chapter 4. Verse 29, Paul says to the Gentile God-fearing believers in the congregations and communities of the provinces of Galatia, he says, "If you are Christ's, then you are Abraham's offspring, heirs according to the promise." Which is to say, if you belong to Messiah, if you are in the Messiah, who is himself the seed of Abraham, Paul has taught us, the singular promised seed of Abraham, then you too may be reckoned to be the seed of Abraham, the spiritual descendants of Abraham, and the fulfillment of God's promises to Abraham. How so? What are those promises? Promise number one, all nations will be blessed in him, in Abraham. Promise number two, all nations will be blessed in his seed, the Messiah. And number three, that he himself, Abraham, will be called Father of many nations. Father of many nations, because although these believers, these Gentiles from the nations, become the spiritual seed of Abraham, so we can say our Father Abraham and so on. And although these Gentiles from the nations attain this fellow citizenship with Israel, with the Jewish people, in the great commonwealth of Israel, nevertheless, Gentile believers do not become and need not become Jewish. Instead, each one of us retains our own distinct nationality. And this is what we learned last week. So the Greek is still a Greek and the Jew is still a Jew, even though they are one in Messiah. Though they be one in Messiah, they are not the same. This is what we learned last week. Therefore, this has the result of many nations comprising this body, and Abraham is called father of many nations, not father of one nation. So, this is what we learned last week. Are you ready to tackle another difficulty? There are a few bumps in the road of Galatians 4 ahead. So Paul continues now in chapter 4, and this is kind of like, you know, we are what? This is like we've done 20 of these sermons or something, 20 weekly lessons to get to this point, and it has a cumulative effect. It's like a soap opera. You can't just drop into the middle of the soap opera, you know. There's a cumulative effect. You gotta know what's going on. There's all these story arcs and that sort of thing. And there's a story arc here that's gonna harken back to several of the things that Paul was presenting to us in chapter 3. For example, he's gonna pull that pedagogue analogy back that we discussed a couple weeks ago. So just to refresh your memory, in that analogy, we learned, Paul says, that the Torah, and more specifically than just the law, that Jewish status, that is being legally Jewish, that is to be halakhically Jewish, legally Jewish, to be under the Torah, is another way he puts it, under the law. To be of the works of the law. These are all different terms for the same thing. He said that this is like a pedagogue, that it served as a pedagogue, this Torah, this Jewishness, this under the lawness, served as a pedagogue, which literally means a child conductor, to bring the Jewish people to the Messiah. So the analogy depends on the role of pedagogue in Roman society, not pedagogue as we would understand it today, because in today's culture, pedagogue means a teacher, but in Roman society, the pedagogue, remember this, he was a household slave that served as a custodian over a minor in the household and supervised the child and took care of the child, protected the child, and arranged the child's education, brought the child to the teacher. And in that analogy that we learned, the Torah, the works of the Torah, legal Jewish status, are like this household slave who cares for, protects, and supervises the child, in this case, the people, until he delivers them to the teacher, which Paul says is Messiah. Okay, that was looking back a little bit. So Paul takes that and he develops that. He's going to develop that a little further today in Galatians 4. Here we go. Here's what he says. Galatians 4, verse 1. I mean that the heir... Here's what I'm saying, he says. The heir, as long as he is a child, a minor, as long as he's a minor, is no different from a slave. Though he is the owner of everything, he is under guardians and managers until the date set by the father. Now, unfortunately, unlike the case of the pedagogue, we don't know the exact social circumstance, legal circumstance Paul invokes for this second run, his second attempt. It's almost like, you got a picture, Paul's like, he's backed up once, he's taken a few steps back and he's going to take another run at this thing. So he's like, he begins this like, here's what I'm trying to say. And he's giving us another analogy. And in this case, we don't exactly know the legal situation he's invoking. But his metaphor is pretty clear and we can recreate it. Okay? So, picture this. A Roman-era household. The father of the house has slaves and a son. The father's son is destined to be the heir to the estate, including the slaves. He'll own the slaves. But he won't come into this inheritance, he's not going to receive this inheritance until he reaches a certain age which has been predetermined by the father. For the sake of this illustration, I think Paul would have us imagine a situation where there's a will and the father has left behind instructions. The father's died. He's left the estate to the son. But with the provision that so long as this son is a minor, a child, he remains a ward of the estate and is not free to dispose of the estate or even free on his own volition to do whatever he wants. Instead, he is entrusted to legal guardians and managers until a certain age, and when he reaches this certain age, then he will come into his inheritance. That's kind of the legal situation that Paul's put up here. So for the sake of illustration, shall we just say it's the age of 18, because that corresponds to legal adulthood in our culture. So we'll just say when the son becomes 18 years old, I knew a kid like this once. He was at the age of 25. His parents had died, but at the age of 25, he knew he was going to inherit $3 million. Totally destroyed his life. It just destroyed his life, knowing that $3 million was out there. Just destroyed his life. Unbelievable. Just no effort into life. Became a stoner. But anyway, that's not the case with this child. This child is under the stewardship of the pedagogue and the household servants and managers and custodians. He doesn't have the option to become a dropout and a stoner. Instead, he's like a slave, Paul says. He doesn't have rights over his own choices. He's just like any other slave in the household, except he owns the whole household. This is the situation. This is what Paul is showing us. He's saying, let me give you an example. This is the example. So in terms of his actual privilege, though he is heir to the estate, his status is not different than a slave of the estate. And though technically he owns the property, he's under custodianship till he turns 18. We made that age up. But so in this regard, his rights over the property are no better than a slave belonging to the property. So this is what Paul's saying. And before we go any further, this is another of those story arcs. We need to reach back into chapter 3. So just rewind a little ways back to chapter 3, verse 15. Rewind the text of Galatians and look at this. Remember this passage? To give a human example, brothers, even with a man-made covenant, no one annuls it or adds to it once it has been ratified. Now, the promises were made to Abraham and to his offspring. It doesn't say, and to offsprings, referring to many, but referring to one, to your offspring, who is the Messiah. This is what I mean. The Torah, which came 430 years afterward, does not annul the covenant previously ratified by God so as to make the promise void. And you remember, as we were learning this text, we learned that covenant here could be understood as a will and testament, last will and testament. For if the inheritance comes by law, it's no longer by promise. So let's see if we understand the parable here now that we've pulled this back in, because Paul's just developed, he's developing this further. Here, I'm going to just throw this out. See if this fits. See if this works for you. Abraham's the father. Abraham is the father. He has entrusted the promises that God made to him to his heirs as an inheritance. What are these promises? The coming of this promised seed. It doesn't say seeds, it says seed. The Messiah, the singular seed. So he's left this promise to his heirs. No one can annul or add to these promises. He has another promise. It says, all nations will be blessed in your seed. All nations will be blessed in you. No one can annul this promise or add to this promise, to this will that's left behind by Abraham, this last will and testament he's left behind. However, the heirs are not yet of an age to inherit those blessings. They are minors. Therefore, a custodianship is appointed over them for the interim. What is the custodianship? It is Torah. 430 years later, it's added, not nullifying the original will and testament left by Abraham. So Paul says, taking another run at this, Galatians 4, I mean that the heir, as long as he's a child, is no different from a slave, although he's owner of everything. But he is under guardians and managers until the date set by the father. In the same way, we also, when we were children, were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. Now, here's another heads up. Pronouns are important. Pronouns are important. What do I mean? Pronouns are important. When Paul says, we also were children, he's not referring to the God-fearing Galatian Gentile believers. We've seen him pull this before. There's a you, and there's a we, and then there's another we. There's you, Gentiles, we, Jews, and we, all of us, Jews and Gentiles, together. And you need to distinguish. We need to distinguish which is which. So when Paul says, we also, when we were children, he's not referring to the God-fearing Gentile Galatian believers. He's talking about Jewish believers. Whether born Jewish or converted into Judaism, legally the people of Israel, Israel proper. So he says, in the same way, we, Jewish people, when we were children, that is to say, prior to the coming of Messiah, we were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. Here's where it goes off the tracks. Because nobody really knows what he's talking about. I mean, this elementary principles of the world business. And there's a lot of ideas. A lot of people have... A lot of people are pretty sure they know what he's talking about. But it looks to me like nobody knows what he's talking about. There's a lot of opinions. No one knows exactly what he meant. He ends up using the same term in Colossians 2, and he uses it twice here in Galatians 4. It's the Greek word stoekion. And it has to do with elements that comprise a series, essential parts, members of a row. For some reason, I'm picturing the periodic table, you know? Elementary principles, those are elements. It's originally a military term. It meant a row, a rank, a file, a line. In Paul's day, the term was used in some different ways. For example, the degrees on a sundial, if you can picture these, you know, the ticks on a sundial, were called stoekion. The letters and syllables and words that comprise a sentence in the study of rhetoric were called stoekion. The basic elements of the cosmos, fire, earth, air, water, earth, wind, fire, yeah, were called stoekion, elementary principles, the elementary principles. And even the simple rudimentary fundamentals of a subject of study, such as the three R's, reading, writing, arithmetic, were called stoekion, elementary principles. So no one's exactly sure in what sense Paul is using this word, or perhaps in another sense that we're not familiar with. Nobody really knows what he means by it, but we'll work around it. Paul says that prior to the coming of the Messiah, that is prior to the date that was set by the Father, the Jewish people were enslaved, so to speak. Not literally. It's an analogy. He's talking in an analogy. It's not literally. They weren't literally enslaved. It's an analogy, and remember, even in the analogy, the heir is not actually a slave. He just feels like a slave. He feels like a slave because he doesn't have any greater privilege than the household slaves. In fact, the household slaves are boss of him while he's a minor. Okay? So Paul says that's like the Jewish people prior to the coming of Messiah. How so? How so? To what were the Jewish people enslaved, or what did they feel like they're enslaved to? Well, we got to remember the greater context, or the greater context is it's clear that Paul is speaking of the Torah and Jewish status, which he refers to as, the elementary principles of the world, the rudiments, the fundamentals of the world. In other words, before Messiah came, the Jewish people were beholden to this basic, elemental, rudimentary stewardship under the authority of the pedagogue to define Jewish status and preserve them, as we learned earlier in the pedagogue analogy. And he says in verse 4, "But when the fullness of time had come, God sent forth His Son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive the adoption as sons." So we learn here, here's what we're learning now. Okay, Messiah was born under the law. What does that mean? It means he was a legalist. No, it means that he was born Jewish. It means that when this baby was born to a Jewish mother, that made him Jewish, and Paul calls that under the law, under the Torah. Why did God send His Son? To redeem those who were under the law. So, why did God send His Son into the world? To redeem only people who are legalists? No, to redeem the Jewish people. To redeem Israel. Yeah, that's right. That fits with the prophecy. So that's that He sends Messiah, born Jewish, to redeem the Jewish people. so that the people of Israel could receive the adoption of sons and be called sons, not just of Abraham, but sons of God. And in the analogy, the fullness of time at which the promised son is born, that is the promised seed of Abraham, corresponds to the time that the father appointed for his son to come into the inheritance. The child turns 18, so to speak. And suddenly, he's no longer under the authority of the slaves, the stewards, the guardians, the pedagogues, the managers of the estate, but in fact, now he owns them and is in authority over them, is lord over them. So what's Paul's point? I mean, it's hard to keep... That's the one thing. Paul's a great teacher, but it's just hard to know what his point is. It's like one of those things where you go, well, that was great. What was it? I don't know. The point of being Jewish is to be preserved, Paul is saying. To be preserved under the Torah, under the pedagogue, to be preserved for this central event, the coming of Messiah. And so then Paul turns his attention back to the Gentile believers. He says, you see, we were under the law, we were Jewish, so that we might be preserved to the coming of the Messiah, to become sons of God. And this was the goal, to become sons of God. There's the point. I found it. To be sons of God. And so he turns to the Gentile believers, and watch those pronouns, watch out for the pronouns. He says in verse 6, and because you are sons, because you Gentiles are sons, God has sent the Spirit of His Son into our hearts. How's this work? Because the Gentile believers are sons of God, God has sent His Spirit into the Jewish people's hearts? No. Now this hour is inclusive. This is the Jews and Gentiles, all believers, hour. So, because you Gentile believers are sons, God has sent the Spirit of His Son into all of our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. So you are no longer a slave, but a son, and if a son, then an heir through God. Great. Got the pronouns figured out at least. Now what does that mean? It's actually not so difficult when you remember the broader context. The broader context is a question of whether... What's the question? The question is whether or not it's needful for a Gentile to become Jewish or not. So the argument, in a nutshell, runs like this. Jewishness and Jewish status, which is a function of the Torah, the works of the law, was meant to preserve the Jewish people for the coming of Messiah. During that time, being Jewish was the only way to have a share in this Abrahamic promise, which resulted in becoming children of God. Now that Messiah has come, however, Jewishness no longer serves that purpose. It does serve other purposes. Paul's not talking about other purposes right now, but it does serve other purposes. It serves other purposes, but not that one. Gentile believers have become sons of God. You know, these Gentile believers, they become sons of God without becoming Jewish. So what then would be the point of them becoming Jewish in order to be preserved to become sons of God, if they're already sons of God? Does that make sense? That's how I understand it. It made sense when I was preparing the sermon. All right, it comes down to this. Paul doesn't think it's appropriate for Gentile believers to become Jewish. That's it. Comes down to that. It's not too difficult to understand. In fact, Paul intended this entire discussion as an argument for Gentile believers to remain Gentile. That's the point of the argument. That's the whole point of the argument. Outside of that argument, the passage raises serious problems. when we remove it from that argument, when we remove it from that context, it raises problems. Because suppose I was to read this passage, let's say I was just like going to the Galatians for some devotional content or something, and I'm a Jewish believer. And so suppose I'm not a Gentile person asking, do I need to become Jewish in order to come to Messiah? Suppose that wasn't a question in my head. It was a question in the first century. It's not a question anymore. Nobody asked this question. This is not a question for people. Well, maybe in the Messianic movement there's some people. But outside of us, nobody is asking this question anymore. Which makes much of this actually not so terribly relevant. Much of the argumentation. Nobody's asking that question. People are asking other questions. No one's asking that question. Suppose I was a Jewish believer saying, you know, what would I be wondering if I was a Jewish believer? So I was a Jewish person today, in today's world, not then, but in today's world, if I was a Jewish person who just came to faith and became a believer, what kind of questions might I be asking? One of them would probably be, do I need to still be Jewish now that I'm a Christian? Do I need to still keep the Torah? Am I obligated to keep the Torah? Was not the question in Paul's day. Was never a question in the days of the apostles. And Galatians is not written to Jewish believers. It's written to Gentiles. But that, aside from that, that was never a question in the apostolic communities of faith. It was just a given. You know what a given is? In math, remember geometry, where you have a given? You start with a set of givens. Like, it's given. It's something that's like, it's self-evident. Something that's obvious and self-evident is where you start with your givens, and then you work the math equation from there. So it's a given, and a strong teaching of Yeshua of Nazareth, that the Torah is still valid, yes. That Jewish believers are still obligated to keep the whole Torah, yes. Including the so-called works of the law, such as circumcision, yes. Jewish believers are obligated to be Jewish, which is the same thing as the above. It's never a question. Not a question, but suppose it was. Suppose it was a question. And as Jewish believers, we turned to the Epistle of Galatians, and we're reading in Galatians 4, and looking for an answer to this question. Suppose that, and since Galatians 4 is not written to Jews, nor written to address that question, but we don't know that. See, this is what everybody tells us that it is. Everybody would be telling us, you need to read Galatians. Have you read Galatians? And so then we go to Galatians to look for the answer to this question. Suppose we did that. Now what happens? If you are asking the wrong question and looking in the wrong place, you will certainly derive the wrong answer. And that's what happens. A Jewish Christian, a Jewish believer reads this passage in Galatians 4, and it says in verse 3, it says, while we were children, we were held in bondage under the elemental things of the world, and that's the Torah. We can see that's the works of the law. So obviously, we are no longer in bondage, therefore we no longer need to observe the Torah, and you get the wrong answer because you're asking the wrong question. Likewise, in Galatians 4:4-5, it says, when the fullness of time came, God sent forth His Son, born of woman, born under the law, that He might redeem those who were under the law, that we might receive the adoption as sons. A Jewish believer looks at this, says Messiah was born under the law, that He might redeem those who were under the law. But we Jewish believers are not under the law anymore. It says were under the law. Past tense. Now we've been redeemed from the law. Wrong answer. Wrong on two counts. First, it does not say were under the law. A literal translation says those under the law. Ongoing, present tense. Those under the law He may redeem. To be under the law is just Paul's way of saying Jewish. Halakhically, legally, Jewish. Second, Messiah did not redeem the Jewish people from the law. He redeemed them from sin. And he redeems them from exile. And he redeems them from the curse of the law. The curse, as we've already learned, but not from the law, not from being Jewish. So, I mean, it's a very, very simple point I'm trying to make. Ask the wrong questions, you get the wrong answers. This is the way it is when you're reading the epistles. So in summary, Paul's only saying, look, Gentiles, what do you want to be Jewish for? What do you want to be Jewish? Don't you know that the main reason that we're Jews in the first place is to bring about Messiah? So that we can be sons of God? And if you already have Messiah and you're already sons of God, what's the point? What do you want to become Jewish for? It's a very narrow argument. It's a very narrow argument. But the problem is when we take it too universally, and you know what, that's not just a problem here. This is a problem with all the epistles. When we're taking personal correspondence as holy writ, you know, nevertheless, as holy writ, this personal correspondence offers us some beautiful spiritual truths on a universal level. Some of the deep mysticism of the early believers and some of the deep mysticism of the Apostle Paul. Let's take a look at that. Paul teaches that believers, both Jewish believers and Gentile believers, have this in common. Both have received the adoption as sons. Not just as sons of Abraham, but as sons of God. How did this happen? It happened like this. What happened was that when we placed our faith in Yeshua of Nazareth, when we bound ourselves to Him, and His faithfulness, Paul says, then God sent forth the Spirit of His Son into our hearts, crying, Abba, Father. I think this is the source of having Jesus in your heart. Have you ever heard about having Jesus in your heart? Do you have Jesus in your heart? My father tells me that my grandmother shuddered at the concept of heart transplants, lest she be given a non-believer's heart. Yeah. She said, I have Jesus in my heart. In Paul's Hebraic idiom, the heart is not actually to be thought of as the organ that pumps your blood. It's an idiom, you know. Instead, the heart, what is it? But you know what the problem is? We also, in English, have an idiom like this, heart. A heart idiom. And what is our English idiom? It's the seat of emotions. The heart. You broke my heart. She broke my heart. You know? She broke my heart. It means, I feel bad. Right? As I have a broken heart. I'm, you know, the owner of a lonely heart. Yes? Right? But not Hebraically. In Hebrew, that is your spleen. Or your kidneys. She broke my kidneys. That's how that would work in Hebrew. Heart is the way we use the word mind in English. So the heart is the seat of intellect. It is your mind. It is your brain. It is the seat of your will and the seat of your reason. And this is important because, you know, maybe sometimes you don't feel like you have Jesus in your heart. I don't feel like I have Jesus in my heart. Well, it's not about how you feel. It's a big deal. And it's the same concept with the Shema. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your mind and all your soul and all your body, all your everything. And it says, these commandments I give you today are to be upon your heart, in your mind, in your memory, in your thoughts, meditated upon, mentally rehearsed. That's what it is to have the Torah written on your heart. It's up here. It's in your will, your decision maker. Yes? So Paul says the Spirit of Messiah is sent forth. God has sent forth the spiritual essence, the being of Messiah. He has sent forth this Spirit of Messiah into our hearts. That is the mind, the intellect, the will, the reason. Into the intellect and the will and the reason of the believer. And that within our inner being, our inner man, Paul sometimes calls it, Messiah is present. The Spirit of Messiah, I should say. The Spirit of Messiah is present in our mind, in our thoughts, in our will, in our being. And what's he doing there? What's he doing there? He's saying, Abba, Father. He's praying. He's crying out to God. The Greek actually says Abba. It says Abba. It says Alpha, Beta, Beta, Alpha. A transliteration. It's not a Greek word. It's not a Greek word. It's an Aramaic word. It's not even a Hebrew word. It's an Aramaic word. What's Hebrew for Father? Av. Av. This is Abba. This is the language of Jesus. This is the language of the Galilee. This is how Galileans talked in the first century. They would say Abba, Ema, not Av and Aim, like the Hebrew. They talked Aramaic. So what is this? Why is this here? Why does Paul transliterate it for people living in Galatia like this? I'll tell you why. I'll tell you what scholars say. This indicates that this is a tradition that was passed on among the early believers, that this is how the apostolic community remembered hearing the voice of Yeshua pray. This is what he prayed. This is how he prayed. He prayed, Abba, Father, Daddy. It's a daddy. It's emphatic. Abba. And it appears here as an apostolic memory. It was passed on to Paul. Peter said to Paul, Paul, you know, the master, he would cry out, he'd pray, Abba. And Paul passes it on to the Galatians. He addressed God as Abba. It's the only explanation for why you would transliterate it like this into Greek. The apostles remembered him praying. You know, it says in Hebrews, it says, there's a memory there. It says in Hebrews, he in the days of his flesh, he offered up both prayers and supplications with loud crying and tears to the one able to save him from death, and he was heard because of his righteousness. Hebrews 5:7. It's a memory. The apostles remembered the sound of his voice, the sound of his prayers, how he cried out, Abba! And it echoes in their minds. The Spirit of Messiah is in their minds echoing, Abba! And he continues to cry out and to pray, Abba, Father, Daddy, because the Spirit of Sonship is within us and we are adopted. Adopted. Everybody is, you know, not everybody is a child of God. Some people think that, you know, well, all human beings, we're all children of God. You hear that kind of sentiment. It's nice. That's a nice way to think of it. Like, well, we're all children of God, aren't we? Well, no. Just because God made us doesn't make us His children. He made frogs. Are frogs children of God? Well, they're all sons of God. You know, it makes us, you know, he's our God, he's our maker, he's our creator. But to be a child of God is a big deal. Amen. That's a big deal. So I desire this. I want this for every one of us, that we know God as Father, Abba, as our master knew him. Not the remote, You know, not the remote, utterly transcendent, unknowable, mysterious Ein Sof, without limitation, the unknowable God, the Creator, the utterly transcendent One, high and lifted up, beyond the universe, beyond... There is no universe. It's all's one. That God is your daddy. To know Him as Abba, Father. And Yeshua of Nazareth, the only begotten Son, the only begotten Son, the only person to ever actually have this relationship with God, has made it available to those who rely upon Him and upon His faithfulness and His connection to Hashem.
And learn from me and find rest for your soul.